Very timely to have the day long yesterday on showing up for the planet, related particularly to climate issues, interrelated with issues of racial justice, the economy, actually very related to gender issues, multiple issues. How many of you were actually at the day long yesterday? That's great. Great. And so that could be part of the backdrop for our exploration today, because for some people, the what is most alive is responding to our multiple crises. I didn't mention the crisis of democracy, very much with us. And so thanks again, particularly to Corey and Bill for their support of and really energy and inspiration for the day yesterday. I think it'll continue to have a significant impact on our world. So last week, I talked particularly about seeing what is alive in one's practice. And for some of us, we may have more time during the pandemic for formal practice or to give attention to our activism and service. Others of us do not have more time, but partly because of the challenges, there may be further impetus to deepen practice. So what I'm encouraging is to see the current time, as I mentioned last week, as also offering gifts. The strange way that crises offer opportunities, that there can be gifts of a time of less to do, or even more difficulties. They can let us see sometimes our places that need work, and they can, especially with the support of community and friends with whom to talk, can inspire us to deepen, to take a challenge as a starting point for deepening. Like the Tibetan phrase from the Lojong, which goes, I like very much, turn all obstacles into the path of practice. Right? You can put that on the refrigerator or whatever, wherever you look at things a lot. And so last time, I particularly talked about three areas of practice where we might deepen. And I wanted to have a particularly a broad sense of practice that doesn't just mean formal meditation. I think last time I talked some about their tendencies in a number of different Buddhist-based communities to focus sometimes on meditation and not have a broad sense of practice. In that way, we're really shortchanging even the tradition, which has in the Noble Eightfold Path eight factors. And so I think that's very important. So I spoke last time about ways of deepening in terms of formal practice, in terms of what we might call informal practice or daily life practice, and then in terms of service or our work in the world or our activism. It could be very much related to what we do, related to yesterday, many people inspired to help to minimize voter suppression in the next election or to work directly on issues of climate or other issues. And so there can be that very broad sense of practice. And we may, in terms of our formal practice, have time to have our practice be more regular or For some of us, it might be to add a second session or maybe a third session to give more of a focus to our formal practice in terms of focusing on a particular teaching. You know, one wonderful practice that I've worked with for about 35 years is a Sabbath practice. We have one day where we do a little more formal practice than usual, and where, if possible, we minimize a lot of ordinary busyness, maybe minimize electronic devices in our life that day. So a number of ways we can really deepen that formal practice. And for some of us, that's the call. And for some of us, it's more to bring more awareness to informal practice, to being more present during the day, during various activities, to find particular activities, maybe walking or cooking, brushing one's teeth, where you say, I want to be more present. Maybe right now, listening to a talk. We can say, let me be more present in my communications, in my speaking, and so forth. And then the third area was bringing our practice more deeply into our, as it were, work, service, activism in the world. What calls me? How am I called to help respond to a world in great need? And, you know, ideally we can be doing all three of these practices, and they very much, you know, that's certainly what calls me. Maybe we deepen especially in one of them, but we have good grounding in the other two, you know. And I was thinking that they can really help each other. I found about a week ago, I was on a Zoom seminar that was very interesting. It was talking about the history where my mom grew up, where two of my grandparents lived in the Bronx in New York, and they had wonderful material of the first half of the 20th century. And one of the things that they highlighted was the work of a Yiddish poet, which I thought was relevant. It's a guy who I hadn't heard of named Abram Ryzin. And he wrote a poem, which I wanted to read, called I and the World, which is very interesting. It's about, he wasn't, I'm sure, talking at all about Buddhist practice, but the poem is about sometimes how if my individual practice is strong, it can really benefit the world. The poem is called I and the World, and it talks about three situations. The first is where I'm actually have a certain strength and I benefit the world, but then sometimes I'm not doing so well, and if the world is doing well, it benefits me. And he said, the hardest time is when neither I nor the world is doing well. So this is what the poem is. Okay. I and the World by Abram Ryzin. If things were bad with all the world and things were good for me alone, I'd surely then invite the world to share the comforts of my home. I'd comfort it, give my caress, and say, don't worry so, dear world, until it slowly came around and stood up straight upon the ground. If all the world were happy now and only I were in pain, I'd come to it and make demand, now you must make me whole again. But things are bad for both of us. The world's in pain and I too now. The world has no one who can help, nor is there one to show me how. I think this was written in the Depression time. And so, I don't know, that's worst case scenario. But then we have Sangha, right? He didn't mention Sangha. It was just I and the world. So if I'm not doing so well and the world's not doing so well, we have Sangha and the Sangha can help. So in any case, what I wanted to explore this evening, and then have us talk together both about the themes this evening and also about what you might have explored in the last week in terms of what's alive for you, what's deepening for you. So what I want to talk about tonight are two central ways, which I mentioned last week, of deepening practice in all three areas. And the two I want to mention are mindfulness of the body and working with reactivity. And these are very relevant for all three areas, and they're right at the heart of our practice. So we can focus on developing mindfulness of the body, as I mentioned, in our formal practice, in our informal practice, in our time in the world. And again, we have a very, for many of us, a deep conditioning that makes it hard to be present in the body. I certainly had this very strongly. You know, I think I've mentioned this from time to time. I remember when I was in my early 20s being a student and walking to where I was taking a class and thinking, I'm not aware of my body at all. I'm like consciousness on a pole. And it was actually a frightening thought. And much of my practice, really, and when I was right before I started practice, and practice has really been, formal practice has been a way to enter into awareness of the body. So we can do this in our formal meditation. We can focus, as we often do, on the breath, which for many of us is a very reliable way of connecting with the body. We can also give a lot of attention to body awareness. And one intermediate or advanced practice is to bring awareness to the entire body, to the whole body, and develop what we sometimes call whole body awareness. This is probably best started in formal meditation. It's something that, if we have well developed, we can bring out into our daily life, into walking, into listening, into talking. As I speak right now, my awareness is also on my whole body. For me, this was a powerful practice. I originally learned it from John Travis and practiced it for about 4 years, including only being aware of the whole body for retreats of up to 2 months. And so it was a deep training to develop awareness of the whole body. It can make a huge difference in daily life. It's not a beginning practice, but it's something that we can work with in formal practice. The way I would recommend doing it would be to do it towards the end. If you have a 30-minute segment, stabilize your attention, and maybe the last 10 or 15 minutes, just be aware of the whole body. And you can even try it right now. The way that I have found it most successful to work with is to have a sense, and try this right now, of the field of the body. And when I was beginning, I remember that I would often almost like have a sense of the boundaries of my body, almost as if I was filling in, coloring, as if I was a kid, and filling in coloring by first sketching out the outer boundaries and then filling in the inner boundaries. So have a sense of the boundaries of your body, and then let the awareness be there in the whole body in a fairly light way. Not overly focused, not necessarily trying to watch every sensation. Oh, there's a sensation in my shoulder, oh, my leg, and so forth. But just a general awareness of sensations in the body without trying to be too precise. And one can use this much like the breath and when the mind wanders, come back to awareness of the body. So this can take some time to develop. How many of you have worked with something like this practice before? Yeah, so several of you. But this is something that can be a focus. It's a major way to develop mindfulness of the body, particularly in a way that connects with daily life. So again, we can also really stay with the breath, be with body sensations, really focus for a sitting or the first part of a sitting just on body sitting, body awareness. And we can also, in terms of the cultivation of awareness in daily life, work with mindfulness of the body. And it's so central. And this is to really follow much of what we've explored, what I mentioned earlier, to be aware of the body and choose maybe one or two activities and bring mindfulness of the body. So, for example, you might, in talking with someone, develop some mindfulness of the body. You could do hold the whole body. That's harder. In one way of listening right now and having some awareness of the body would be just to be aware of your hands. You can try that. That's usually more accessible. You can do that during meetings. You can do that during other Zoom sessions, being with family or friends. Just be aware of your hands, or be aware of your hands and your feet, or the contact with the chair. That's one way to cultivate mindfulness of the body in ordinary activities. Or in walking, do a period of walking meditation every day and just bring your awareness to your body. It could be the whole body. It could be just being aware of each leg as it's moving through space as you're walking. Again, can be aware of other activities of the body and other activities, cooking, washing the dishes, maybe taking a shower, brushing your teeth. Choose one area and try to stay with it for the next week. And then the last area of one's work or service or activism, being with the body can also be quite important. I think in the context of larger social issues, I actually think that having contact with the body and being aware of the body goes against a lot of prevailing social tendencies. And I think it's actually, I don't know, a minor revolutionary act to be aware of the body. Certainly, the conditioning I had as a man was not to be aware of my body, very linked to not being aware of my emotions, not being able to be very expressive, to be vulnerable. I think awareness of the body opens up all these areas and is, I think, significant also at the social level. And again, in one's work or service or activism, can I keep contact with my body so that whatever I'm doing doesn't become entirely intellectual? Again, the body can be one of the ways we unify our being. We connect the mind and the heart and the body. We're more integrated. We're not exclusively in the cognitive realm. Again, I think that's a precursor of a new way of being. You know, as in our culture, we're going so much into more exclusively cognitive dimensions with electronic devices and so forth. So being with the body is, I think it's radical. And I think it's possible, although it's hard, to be with the body while with electronic devices. Easier if you're listening like now. But I notice, I check in periodically. I'm still aware of my body. someone, when we get to a discussion time, you can ask me, Donald, are you still aware of your body? You can check in. So mindfulness body relevant in all three of these areas, and is, I think, so central for all three, given our conditioning. And then the second area I wanted to talk about is also very relevant for all three areas. And this is working with reactivity. And I've spoken at times at the Marin Sangha about how I like to use reactivity as the translation for the word dukkha, usually translated as suffering, which I think can be a very confusing translation. And so first, a few words about the core teaching from 2,600 years ago. The Buddha said, I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. And I think this is right at the center of our practice in all three of these areas, formal practice, informal practice, and also in our action in the world. So that's what I'll speak about. Then we'll open things up to discussion. And so the traditional understanding of dukkha for us, I think, is often confusing, in large part because the Buddha had at least four different understandings of dukkha. But he gave them at different times. He didn't say, all right, practitioners, I've got four different understandings of dukkha. And here's how they're unified, and here's how to practice, and here's how to understand them. Rather, because it was an oral tradition, he just taught them, and it's confusing because there are different understandings of what dukkha is. The first sense of dukkha, which traditionally is called dukkha-dukkha, is the dukkha as the unpleasant. It's dukkha as what's painful. This is the understanding of dukkha that we have in the teachings on Vedana, her feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The unpleasant is called dukkha. And this is related. The etymology of the word dukkha is connected, as some of you know, with the word for an axle of a cart that is off center, so there's a bumpy ride. So human life generally has axles that are not straight. So at times there are bumpy rides. And that's a kind of dukkha. So the Buddha would sometimes speak about old age is dukkha, illness is dukkha, death is dukkha. But if we're looking for the meaning of the end of dukkha, it can't mean the end of the unpleasant, right? Because the unpleasant still occurs. The Buddha, being fully awake, had unpleasant experiences. When he was older, he had headaches and a bad back. On that first notion of dukkha, that's still dukkha, but the Buddha said, I have reached the end of dukkha. So that's not the essential meaning. And similarly, the second notion of dukkha, and that, by the way, that first sense of dukkha is often what's translated as suffering, which I think is very confusing because in English, first of all, pain and suffering are not always distinguished. And we may have a different understanding of suffering than simply being the unpleasant, but there's not a clear understanding of that. The second meaning of dukkha is called viparinama dukkha, and that's the dukkha that's there when the pleasant necessarily changes and becomes unpleasant. It's the dukkha, it's the what was called the pain of alternation. But again, if we want to ask, does this clarify what the end of dukkha means? No. Because even if we're fully awakened, the pleasant will sometimes go to the unpleasant, and we presume that's not a problem. So that's not the meaning. That's not the core meaning of dukkha. And the third understanding of dukkha is one that you'll often hear, is this is called sankhara dukkha, and this is the sense of dukkha as conditioned, as referring to conditioned phenomena, that there sometimes is said to be a way that any conditioned phenomena, any sight, smell, taste, idea, any experience we have will not give lasting satisfaction. And for that reason is dukkha. Everything will change. We can't hold on to it. And so we can't get lasting satisfaction. But again, does that clarify what the end of dukkha means? I would say no. The end of conditioned phenomena not giving full satisfaction never ends. That's just a condition of life. So it doesn't make sense of the end of dukkha. Are you with me so far? Can you see how there's so much confusion with all this? It's interesting. You know, I think whenever we translate dukkha as suffering without a very, very clear and precise definition, there's going to be confusion. And there's confusion if we talk about dukkha's unsatisfactoriness, at least in terms of the core meaning that we're looking for of what does the end of dukkha mean. That's what the Buddha's pointing to in his teachings. That's what the Four Noble Truths are about. The third truth is the end of dukkha. So many of you know, I think, what the answer is. I think that the answer to this question comes through my favorite teaching, the two arrows. Yay, two arrows. Everyone remember the two arrows? Most people do. So the two arrows, I think, clarifies what the end of dukkha means. That's the teaching where the Buddha said everyone at times is shot by an arrow when something unpleasant occurs. Unpleasant body sensations, unpleasant emotions, unpleasant interactions with people, injustice, unfairness, and so forth, related to social events. That is what the Buddha called the first arrow. And everyone at times is shot by the first arrow, whether one is awake or not, whether one is a practitioner or not. So that doesn't get at what the end of dukkha means. But the Buddha said that because we're shot by the first arrow at times, we will tend, if we're not fully awake, to shoot a second arrow as if this would help get rid of the first arrow. So I have unpleasant body sensations, I tense, or I blame someone, I blame myself, I blame someone else. You know, trip over something that my partner left in the house, and I blame my partner for my unpleasant sensations. That's the second arrow. Someone says something I don't like, I react back, I shoot the second arrow back. Someone does something I don't like, I'm judgmental. That's the second arrow. Right? And similarly on the social level, one group does something, another group, one country does something, another country shoots the second arrow through violence. So the second arrow is very predominant. And it's this that the Buddha said is possible to eliminate. The end of dukkha is not to shoot the second arrow. But further, we can see that that shooting of the second arrow could also be called reactivity, the reactivity we have towards the unpleasant. And I would say that's one form of reactivity. The other form of reactivity is grabbing after the pleasant, right? And so the end of dukkha, I would say, is the end of reactivity. It's the end of shooting the second arrow, which is the pushing away. It's the end of grabbing hold of things in a compulsive, semi-conscious way. Again, distinguished from when we more consciously or skillfully reach towards someone, something, you know. So again, it's awareness and wisdom, which is the distinguishing factor. So another way to say this is our practice is coming to non-reactivity. So again, this is such a fundamental teaching, and it's something that we can follow in all three of these areas. It can be a powerful North Star for our practice in any of these three areas or all of them. So we could, in our formal practice, say, after I, in the first part of the sitting, stabilize my attention, I'm going to try to be attentive to every moment of reactivity, how it occurs when I react, again, compulsively, semi-consciously, semi-automatically, and push away something, either physically or in my formal meditation, it could be being judgmental, thinking negative thoughts. It could manifest as frustration, anger, anxiety, all sorts of emotions, right? And so we can be on the lookout in our formal meditation for moments of that kind of reactivity as well as the grabbing hold. And just notice, again, that can occur in all sorts of ways. It can be occur mentally or emotionally, and so forth. Again, distinguished, these two forms of reactivity have the qualities of being compulsive, semi-conscious, fairly automatic, and they're distinguished from the times that we skillfully and consciously say, no, I'm not going there, or I want that, or that would be good, you know? So I can take a second piece of cake reactively or skillfully. Maybe we'll do that next week. We'll skillfully, non-reactively have that second piece of cake. Okay, up to you to see into it. So we can work with reactivity in our formal practice. It's a powerful way to work. We can also do that in our informal practice. We can do both. We can work with reactivity, and a lot of what we do in our formal practice is we get very savvy about our main forms of reactivity. That's what can occur in formal practice. It's one of the reasons it's so powerful. For me, I've been teaching a lot on the judgmental mind. That came out of several years of closely studying my judgmental mind in formal meditation. That's where it came out of, including on retreats when it was happening a lot. And studying that so much, one gets a sense of, I got a sense of what the dynamics are. And that's what we want to do in our formal meditation. What are the dynamics of my top five forms of reactivity? And can I name them? And then we bring it into our informal practice as well. We can do this kind of cultivation of awareness in the informal practice, and then in my formal practice, maybe at the end of a sitting, I say, let me look out for reactivity during the day. Or I'm having a difficult discussion with this person, this friend, this partner. Let me aspire to track my reactivity. So let me notice my reactivity. And then the other dimension of it is we learn how to proceed in challenging areas non-reactively. Again, a whole area, I won't go into it so much now, speech and communication practice. How can I speak about difficult circumstances? Maybe I'm upset, frustrated with something that's happened or not happened. How can I communicate non-reactively about something that which originally led me to be reactive? Big part of our practice. How can I respond to another person non-reactively? Again, we could take the next 5 weeks on that. You know, and we explore that a lot in our mindful communication retreats that I often do with Oren. And then the last area, and then we'll open things up. How do we bring this understanding of the end of dukkha into our work in the world, our service, our activism? Again, many of the same emphases that I've mentioned, being able to be non-reactive with difficult situations, conflicts, differences, to be able to work skillfully with conflict. Very, very crucial capacity to be able to be skillful in our speech, as I mentioned, when there are differences, conflicts, challenging situations, difficult emotions, is so crucial. And, you know, we learn it maybe in our informal time, our time with people close to us or at work and so forth. And then we bring it into the world. And I've often mentioned that there are very close parallels between, I believe, the Buddha's teaching of the two arrows and the teaching of the end of dukkha and the traditions of nonviolence. No coincidence that Marshall Rosenberg, in developing nonviolent communication, explicitly referred to traditions of nonviolence. And in that approach to speech and communication, there are a lot of pointers towards how to be non-reactive in challenging situations. Gandhi and King did the same with somewhat extreme social circumstances. And I think this is very much called for now. How do we respond fully to the climate crisis or to racial injustice or to the crisis of democracy? And how do we do so in a way in which we practice to be non-reactive? Again, I think we can get a lot from the traditions of nonviolence. Very, very powerful. Let me see if I have a reading. And we talked about this some yesterday in the climate approach. This is from Dr. King. The end represents the means in process and the ideal in the making. The means must be as pure as the end. That's at the heart of nonviolence. In other words, very hard to resolve a problem reactively because we set in motion future reactivity. Another quote from Dr. King, the end is reconciliation, the end is redemption, the end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of human beings. So this sense, as we work with challenging social situations, of bringing the teaching of dukkha and the end of dukkha into those situations as well, including on a large scale. I think that's, again, very, very possible. It's a vision. It's really a vision that lets us bridge our formal practice, our informal practice, and our work in the world. And so we can really work with these two core teachings. And perhaps this is what, maybe these resonate with you. But we can work with these teachings at whatever level we're most inspired. Again, remembering that's what's most crucial is to see what makes one come alive. There are cycles for being more inner, being more outer. What makes us come alive in our practice? But know that the three are connected, and we can, you know, especially, you know, my emphasis tonight, work with these two really, really fundamental teachings in each of the three areas. So let me finish there and maybe invite us just to pause for a moment. And ask yourself, what was most helpful or resonant for you? Maybe not necessarily even in anything I said, but something that got awakened for you. What's alive?
I really am grateful for your talking about reactivity as clarifying the end of suffering. To me, that really made that term reactivity come alive for me, which really hasn't before. So I'm very grateful for that, because now I suddenly could see, talk about looking at the dynamics of reactivity and be able to get more on the idea of how the second arrow works in me. So I, for some reason, those words just work.
Yeah. It's again, it's confusing because the different meanings of dukkha are given. And if you hear different teachers, usually dukkha is understood as suffering, right? So, and what does the end of suffering mean? Sometimes it can make some sense, but sometimes not. Anyone like to raise hand? I see Liz and Sarah. Maybe you can use either raise your hand. I can't see everyone, but you can do that or use the raise hand function. So we'll go to Liz and then Sarah. So and Corey, can you track also if anyone uses the raise hand function? Liz, please.
Thanks for a very meaningful talk. I really appreciate it. One thing about reactivity is not causing harm for me.
Yeah.
Not returning. I'm working very strongly with not returning in kind.
Yeah.
As an intention, which has been working sometimes and sometimes not, but it has been working at times. Not to return what's coming at me in kind.
Mm-hmm.
Is doing less harm.
Yeah, Liz, what, sorry. Liz, or what helps you not to return in kind?
The intention and the thought.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think it. But also I want to relate it to the body.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am not a body person. I've never been in my body, really. I've never really inhabited it there. I've never thought about it until very recently. Mm. And I found it interesting because you say that's radical. I don't understand why that's... It's radical for me. That's true.
Yeah.
And perhaps it was radical for you from what you've been saying.
Yeah.
To inhabit the body. And the whole body breathing, which was introduced to me by John Travis many, many years ago, I think, has been very, very, very important to me for years. And I practice it quite a bit now. It's a very important practice, full body breathing. I practice it a lot.
Yeah. But
why is it radical when the first foundation of mindfulness is the body, in the body? So how is it? It's radical for me, but why do you call it radical?
Radical in terms of a lot of prevalent conditioning, particularly for men.
Okay, well, for
me it's not radical in terms of the Buddha.
Yes, right. But also being in a body is being present. One is more present when one is in the body. And I think that that is grounding, which could lead to less reactivity, to be aware of the body.
Very, very much, because so much of the reactivity is like the mental loops.
Yes.
Right. And the mental loops, and when we're in our body, we move away from what I call the dominance of the automatic mind.
Absolutely.
Really crucial.
It's been a blessing to be able to do it. Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. Sarah, please.
Actually, I was waving at the cat and the neighbors trying to signal I'm taking a class right now. Keep going without me. It wasn't really a raised hand.
Okay.
But I'll only say this, and that is that I have found reactivity and reactivity in the body to be extremely helpful. I think I've mentioned more than once. Thank you for that definition. It really has been useful and helpful and quite a wonderful practice. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks, Sarah. I think Veda, please.
So I've had a right speech practice for 20 years. And for some reason tonight, Donald, I'm connecting that to reactivity. How I respond verbally, I don't know how to explain it, but somehow there's a connection tonight that I did not have before tonight. So thank you.
Very welcome. That's what we're looking for. New connections. Right? So, but it's also mysterious how insight occurs, right? Or how connections occur. You know, that you've been, as it were, cultivating the field for so long that something can occur like that. Yeah. Thanks. Could be comment, question. Corey, did you have your hand? Yeah.
Yeah, Donald, you know, been reading a lot about trauma lately, and yesterday that came up in the climate dialogue as well.
Yeah.
And I'm reading the My Grandmother's Hands Right Now book. And,
right.
You know, there's a lot more awareness of that, and it certainly has been in my life, and how reactivity is so intimately tied to that trauma. Do you have anything to say about that or any connections that you've been making with trauma lately with this work?
It's important. Essentially, again, people use the word trauma in a number of different ways. And I went through the 3-year somatic experiencing training. And the main trainer I worked with, this is a training purportedly in trauma, he didn't like to use the word trauma, actually. He used the phrase dysregulation of the nervous system. Trauma is used quite broadly. And like yesterday, Kriti was talking about trauma as being there, you know, in some way for as much as half the population, right? And so, when we talk about dysregulation of the nervous system, often what that means is that we're trapped in forms of reactivity that originated from overwhelming experiences from our past. And those overwhelming experiences may have been what are more usually connected with the word trauma, maybe an accident or abuse or something like that, but they also can be there for developmental challenges. You know, they can be there and challenges in the family situation, such as a divorce, or even circumstances like, I don't know, encountering the cruelty of other children. You know, so one thing, again, that my teacher trainer during my trauma training emphasized, he said, this kind of reactivity, we want to focus on the particular system rather than the event. Because one child can fall off a bicycle and have something that develops into what we might call trauma, and another child, or maybe most children, that doesn't occur. Right? So the nature of what we're talking about is some habitual reactivity coming from a very difficult or overwhelming experience that gets triggered by certain stimuli, and one goes into this automatic reactivity as if it would help one. One goes back, and typically this is understood as trying to fight, trying to flee, or freezing. And so the reactivity can be of all three kinds, or any of those three kinds. And but the sense is that there's some kind of triggering, and one goes into the reactivity. So, for example, I'm working with someone quite regularly now who's working with childhood trauma. And for her, she knows the patterns very well, but even so, certain events, certain communications with members of her family can trigger that reactivity. And the characteristic of the trauma is that it's often on that level, when it's related to overwhelming events or very difficult events from the past, it can be very hard to work with, and we may not be able simply to use mindfulness. We may need first to come back to balance. And, you know, in what's called trauma work, there are typically ways of going very lightly and gently into traumatic material for a short time, releasing it a little bit, and then coming back to base. So that's a technique that we can use with more intense forms of reactivity. So that's a beginning. Does that start to get at some things?
Yeah, very helpful. Thank you. I think you're right. I think that mindfulness, when it's related to something that is traumatic, where that's the trigger, then I think you're right that sometimes mindfulness is maybe a later on practice.
Either a later on practice or actually contraindicated.
Yeah.
And when I was doing the trauma training, we had a group of about 6 or 8 meditation teachers or senior students. And we actually, some of them reported having been at meditation retreats, gone into traumatic territory, and had the teacher say, just stay with it. Not skillful guidance, because they were uninformed about trauma. So, the person said, I kind of knew what was happening, but I actually had no way of being mindful. So maybe time for one more, and then we'll go to the meta cards. Anyone else want to comment? Or Maria, please. Is it Maria?
It's Marta.
Marta, I'm sorry. I didn't read it accurately. Sorry.
It made me think about care, because when we're not reacting or sending the second arrow, then what we can do is to take care of the wound or the feeling, or to celebrate the positive, pleasant sensation instead of grabbing the next ones. So really made me think about taking care and enjoying the care. And also in my work in community, now, especially with natural disasters, instead of like trying to change what is not working, that is not helping the people, just going to compassion and care and making sure that resources are there for people. So thank you.
Yeah. No, it's really, it's a great point. A lot of reactivity, you know, I've explored this and looking at the nature of the judgmental mind, quite a lot of reactivity is sort of pushing people away because I'm in pain, which actually doesn't always help very much. It can get us into cycles of pain when what's being called for is caring for myself. You know, I want to, you know, it's valuable to set boundaries often, but a lot of the reactivity is because there's pain here that if I really knew, a lot of reactivity, in other words, is generated by unacknowledged or unprocessed pain. And if I can actually go beneath the reactivity, I can actually say, oh, that doesn't feel good. Let me care for myself. So I think very much on focus there. Yeah. Thank you.